You're a civil attorney, is that correct?
I am. I'm a civil rights attorney, police misconduct attorney in New York. I actually was talking just now about how I was on CKLN, a community radio station very similar to this one, rooted out of Ryerson University in Toronto. I was actually between degrees at that point. I was and finished my undergrad degree and was working in Toronto for about 8 years before I went to law school.
We're here today to talk about content of the book that you co-authored. How did this book come to be?
It came to be, it really was the product of three people's work, and it's sort of a very interesting process. When three people write something, it's very different than either one of them could write alone. But we came together because all of us had been in different circles, but around the same periods of time, trying to raise issues around the treatment of LGBT people in the criminal legal system. I have always been focused on policing issues, and so had been working on policing issues as they affected women of color in Toronto particularly. And then when I came to the States, also as they were affecting LGBT people and LGBT people of color. And I had done some research for Amnesty International that produced a report called Stonewalled: Police Abuse and Misconduct Against LGBT People in the United States. And in that context, had come across one of my co-authors, Joey Mogul, who is a police misconduct attorney in Chicago, Illinois, who had been representing LGBT people in police misconduct matters and criminal matters and death penalty matters for some time, and had also come across my other co-author, Kay Whitlock, who for a long time worked for the American Friends Service Committee as their head of LGBT issues, and had really been doing incredible work in sort of trying to bring criminal justice issues to the center of that conversation and LGBT issues to the center of LGBT issues to the center of criminal justice conversations, and had produced a number of very interesting publications around that, which we had all been accessing and using in our advocacy. And we just would cross paths periodically and always feel like we were voices in the wilderness. We would always be two people on a panel that was raising issues that people weren't really thinking about or having trouble thinking about. And so when we had the good fortune to have Beacon Press approach us to write the book that we had all been dreaming of writing in different forms and in different ways for years. And so it just seemed natural that the three of us would come together to do that. And it was an extremely exciting process and project. And that's how it came about.
How is the word queer used throughout the book?
I think we use the word queer for a number of reasons. One, for me, the main one is that it seems the acronyms LGB or the letters LGBT don't encompass the full spectrum of the things that we talk about in the book, which include anything that's actually or perceived to be sexually nonconforming or gender nonconforming, that kind of behavior or expression or personhood is criminalized. And that doesn't necessarily only apply to people who would identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. It applies certainly to people who fall within that category, but also to people whose gender and sexuality is presumed to be sexual, to be deviant by society. So that could include many women of color who aren't same gender loving or transgender. It can mean anyone who engages in the sex trade. It can mean anyone who engages in sexual practices that people consider to be deviant or nonconforming. And so we focus on people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, or to a certain extent two-spirit, but we don't limit it to that. And we try and show that there are connections in terms of how everyone's sexuality and gender expression is policed and punished in society. And so we wanted to use the word queer to represent that. We also wanted to use it to reclaim a history of resistance to the criminal legal system and a broader politic that's about challenging the state as an oppressive structure, as opposed to one that we just want to be included in order to participate in structures that are oppressive. So we really wanted to hearken back to that politic that we think was more radical around that, and to say that we were not about assimilation, but about challenging oppressive structures and about liberation. So that was the other reason we used the word queer.
Another language thing that was brought up in the book was using the term criminal legal system instead of as a replacement for criminal justice system. Would you be able to explain that decision?
Similarly, we felt like the criminal legal system has never produced anything that remotely resembled justice for so many of the people that we were talking about, that it seemed almost cruelly ironic to use that system. And to call it the criminal injustice system, I mean, I think would also have been appropriate, but we really also just wanted to name it for what it is, which is a legal system that criminalizes certain behaviors and certain conduct, certain expressions and certain identities, and does so in a legal way, but in a way that has structural ramifications beyond the legal system. So it was a way to describe a mechanism of implementing larger structures of oppression, and certainly one that's completely unrelated to justice for people of color in the United States, and I would argue in Canada and around the world for a very long time.
How did you come to be invested in these topics?
For me, I think the questions of policing have always been really critical to me, because I do see the police as sort of the front line of so many systems of violence and repression. I think that they really are the kind of frontline enforcers of so many systems of domination in society, and that those systems get codified in criminal laws or in police actions. So police enforce laws that are unjust. They also in many ways make law, because they're given so much discretion, particularly over certain populations like indigenous populations, people of color, women, queer people, and they're given sort of such discretion and control over those populations to maintain control, to maintain the social order that they're being ordered to maintain, that I feel like they really represent the front lines and represent the enactors, and the day-to-day contact that they have with people really is where the real nitty-gritty of how systems of oppression play out happens. So I started actually my work around policing issues in Toronto, like your producer just reminded me, over 20 years ago, looking at how police responded to violence against women, and then also looking at how police perpetrate violence against women, and particularly women of color, and really always felt like as agents of the state and as people who, particularly the mainstream women's movement, has framed and shaped as protectors, we really need to look at their behavior, in fact, as perpetrators of violence and as representations of systemic violence. I think also because in the U.S., we're having this conversation about mass incarceration, about the fact that there's literally now 2 million people in cages in the United States, the vast majority of whom are people of color, African-American and Latino women and men. That's a crisis. It's a crisis of mass incarceration. It's one that's drawing a lot of attention, but people often forget that people don't just show up in prison. Like, someone puts them there, and the person who puts them there is a police officer, and literally one encounter with a police officer, depending on who they decide to surveil, who they decide to harass, who they decide to question, who they decide to demand identification from, who they decide to arrest, can literally change that person's, the entire course of that person's life. And that, to me, seemed like a power that absolutely needed to be examined and to challenged and checked to the extent possible, given that the social state structure that we're in.
So yesterday, when Gary Kinsman was speaking, he spoke about the seeing things in the historical present. So, why is it important to understand issues in that way? Why do you think it's important to understand issues in this way?
I think there's an interesting quote by James Baldwin that opens up the history chapter in our book, where James Baldwin, who's African-American, gay, but I mean, I don't know if he identified as gay. He was definitely queer and radical. He has a quote, we quoted him saying, you know, the history is literally present in everything that we do. And I think Gary was saying that last night as well. And it's very true. I mean, we in the book sort of chronicle how from the moment Christopher Columbus first set foot on the shores of what's now known as the Americas, originally was known and still known as Turtle Island. At that moment, the policing of gender and sexuality was being deployed as an instrumental tool for colonialism, for theft of land, for genocide, for dragging people across through the Middle Passage and chattel slavery, the maintenance of chattel slavery, and the exclusion of undesirables at the borders. And it was interesting because Gary was saying that most people will now accept that as a principle, but they won't accept that that continues in the present day. And so in the book, we sort of really trace arcs of history literally through the present, and we do that in a lot of ways, but by showing similarities between types of policing that were happening in the past and types of policing that were happening in the present. So, for instance, there were vagrancy laws that were enacted immediately after chattel slavery was abolished to basically force African descended people back into slavery. So if you were outside and black, there were literally different laws for people who were black and white. And if you're outside and black and not working at any given time of day or night, the police could arrest you, put you back into prison, and then lease you out through a convict leasing system. So that was a way of reenacting slavery through the criminal legal system. Now, there are things called quality of life laws, where basically if you're loitering, which means standing outside, or you're framed by a police officer to be disorderly or acting inconsistent with your place in the social order, or your body is seen as out of place in a particular location by a police officer, you can be picked up, arrested, put into the criminal legal system and sent to a private prison where you'll have to work for 8 cents a day and make corporations big money. That to me seems like a pretty clear historical arc where we don't call them vagrancy laws anymore, but they operate in exactly the same way and they produce the same results, which is massive numbers of people of color in prison. And so reinforcing a social order or an economic order that's oppressing them. In other ways, it's not so obvious. And I think this was also what Gary was getting at last night, where in the book, we talk about these things called archetypes, which are literally, they're more than stereotypes. Stereotypes are sort of, you know, fairly flat. You know, all gay people are good hairdressers or something like that. They're ideas about people and generalizations about people and can be very harmful. But the things that we were talking about more were these sort of socially constructed stories around queer people and who we are that become so entrenched in people's minds that they can't literally cannot think of people in a different way, even when the situation that's actually in front of them doesn't match up with what the story is. And so Gary's book talks a lot about queers as a security threat, of LGBT people as literally a threat to the fabric of the security of the nation. And he was talking about it in the sense of the Cold War era, this notion that that because homosexuals were hiding something about themselves, they were easily blackmailed or extorted by the other side, by Soviet agents, and therefore were more likely to be literally a threat to the national security of the Canadian state. And I believe that that still is, and he was saying that that still is the case today. But we were also talking last night about how that story continues to play out in the way that LGBT people or queer people are perceived in society, even when we're not having a Cold War anymore and we don't, you know, there's not that same structure. LGBT people are still perceived as literally a threat to the security of a community, to the security of social fabric, to the security of the nation as well. So for instance, one thing I was thinking about when he was speaking last night is that right after 9/11, there was quite a bit of conversation about men dressing as women and how we absolutely had to be careful about men dressing as women. And we had to have all these security measures in place because they were afraid that, you know, terrorists would cross-dress in order to deceive authorities and be able to continue to pose the threat that they did to the nation's security. And that, of course, placed transgender people, and particularly transgender people of South Asian or Middle Eastern or Arab descent, and in those communities, at tremendous risk because they were therefore perceived immediately as a security threat. There is also something I talked about last night at the event, this notion that young LGBT people of color are a threat to communities. And even when those communities are ostensibly sort of gay communities like the West Village in New York City, and Gary was talking about how the identity of being LGBT is constructed primarily as white, and then therefore people of color who come into those communities are constructed as automatically there to commit violence against people who belong there, who are white and gay, instead of being seen as who they are, which are young queer people coming to experience queerness where they see that it's visibly located. And so those kinds of present manifestations of historical stories that sort of change over time to meet different social conditions, but manifest in ways that you can trace back to the original sort of the origin of those stories is really important for us to continue to watch and understand the many ways in which gender and sexual nonconformity is policed and punished in very racialized ways.
So you've addressed how it is historically, whatever, like it's present and it's like historically rooted. So who is benefiting from sort of, as, yeah, like Kinsman referred to, the socially organized forgetting? Who, like, why, what is the incentive of maybe mainstream movements to sort of like disseminate this idea that there should be more of a celebration of gains rather than a focus on, like, I think this also happens with in other areas where, or in conversations where attention is drawn to gains, or it's kind of like it's better than it was. How do you respond in those situations?
Yeah, I was really empathizing with Gary last night when he was talking about how people have a hard time hearing these things, particularly in Canada, where, you know, there's been marriage, gay marriage for some time now, and we just recently in New York State, where I live, the law was passed legalizing gay marriage, and there really is the sense that, you know, we've arrived. And meanwhile, the people I work with and talk to have arrived nowhere different than where they were the day before that law was passed. And so, well, of course, as Gary was saying, I mean, it's not a bad thing, but what is bad is the notion that it perpetuates, which is that that has now resolved all issues of discrimination for LGBT people. And I think the way that that story continues to be perpetrated and perpetuated is because policing and punishment is increasingly focused on the more marginalized members of LGBT communities. So as sort of policing and raids of bars, for instance, or policing and raids of for lewd conduct, or policing and raids for the sex trades or involvement in prostitution have focused more on low-income, poor communities of color, on establishment frequented by LGBT people of color, on low-income, street-based transgender women of color, or LGBTQ youth of color. When the policing and punishment focuses on more marginalized members of the community, it's easier, and it for people who are not experiencing that anymore, or experiencing it to a lesser degree, and trading on economic and skin color and racial and gender privilege to access more and more of mainstream society, then it's in their interest to distance themselves from people who are still criminalized. And there's one very important quote in our book where we cite a law professor in the States, Ruth Ann Robson, who very eloquently states, you know, that as distance from criminality has become a precondition for equality, and really that at this point what it benefits the white mainstream middle class gay movement to forget about the stories that are told in queer injustice, because that would undermine their notion that the society that they're assimilating into is just and is becoming more and more equal every day, when in fact that's not the case. And it also requires them to reach out and be in solidarity with people in their community who they may be participating in the oppression of.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what I was thinking about when you were saying that, well, it reminded me of when I was in Women's and Gender Studies, like an introductory course, and we would sometimes talk about, like mainstream notions of equality, like Ellen being a really popular television program, or things like that.
I think it's very interesting when you bring up television, because it's one of the ways in which we talk about in the book that these kinds of stories about queer people are reproduced and entrenched. And so while Ellen was sort of being put out there and everyone was like, look, you have Ellen, clearly you've arrived, everything's okay. Meanwhile, stories about queers as sexual predators, as disease spreaders, as gleeful killers were being promoted at the same time through movies like Silence of the Lambs, where there's a gender deviant or gender nonconforming person who's literally going out and killing women and sewing up their skin into clothing, you know, that's actually loosely based on the story of a real person. And Hannibal Lecter, who, you know, in the Silence of the Lambs is a very gleeful gay killer, even though he's framed as heterosexual in some ways. There is every cop show, you know, saying where they show the interrogation scene where the officer is telling the person that if they don't tell them what they want them to, you know, what they want them to tell them, that they'll find themselves, you know, in prison, you know, being Jamal or Bertha's, you know, insert expletive here, you know. And we all know what color the person is who's conjured up in the imagination when we say Jamal or Bertha, and we all who's, you know, the prison rapist. And that's a long story of gays in prisons or queers or lesbians in prison or queers in prisons that are framed as being sexually predatory and as, you know, the people to be avoided at all costs, and that you have to comply with society's rules or you'll be sent to prison, which is this big queer space where queers of color will subject you to their forms of degradation. And so Ellen and the existence of Ellen does nothing to disrupt those narratives and does nothing to disrupt those perceptions of queers that are used and deployed and re-entrenched through the media to criminalize LGBT people. So while Ellen was on TV, you know, these images were being reproduced as well, but they were being reproduced to criminalize and punish the bad queers and the queers of color and the incarcerated queers and the queers who were engaged in deviant sexual activity or who are naturally depraved such that they, you know, are serial killers or sociopaths. And as long as Ellen could keep her distance from those people, then we wouldn't think of them as even the same people, which is the other reason we didn't want to use LGB or T, because that tends to be the sanitized version of our community, not the full version of our community that that is targeted in these kinds of ways.
Speaking of pop culture representations, well, one of the stories that had struck me, well, also because I saw this film, Monster, was the example of Eileen Wuornos and how her case played out in courts. And either if you would like to speak about that story in the context of how it was in the book, or another story that particularly stays with you from, and there were so many stories like that. And also, are they perhaps the most, maybe like perhaps the most extreme stories are used to like make these points, but also how extreme are they?
Definitely. Yeah. That is a question. How are they really extreme, or are they just sort of, the way I often characterize it when I think about it is there's this sort of low-grade fever of homophobia that pervades policing and punishment of sexual and gender nonconformity. There's sort of this low-grade racialized homophobia and transphobia that's out there all the time. And then there's an acute outbreak sometimes in particularly cases like the Wuornos case or in death penalty cases where it's sort of projected large in really kind of cartoonish ways, but that we see the same dynamics play out on a day-to-day basis. So the Eileen Wuornos case is a really good example of, you know, the story that was playing in that case was the lethal lesbian, we call it. And basically it's that there's man-hating lesbians out there who are just dying to go around killing men. They hate men and they kill them whenever they're presented with the opportunity to. And that story is so deeply entrenched that people could not see Eileen Wuornos as a survivor of child rape. They could not see Eileen Wuornos as a survivor of adult rape. They could not see Eileen Wuornos as a survivor of poverty and criminalization of sex work in this country. They couldn't see all of the ways in which Eileen Wuornos was subjected to violence in almost every form every day of her life. They could only see the horror of the violence that she engaged in, and they couldn't hear her argument of self-defense either. And so they decided that she was in fact a monster and needed to be put to death. And that, as I say, is a fairly sort of writ large example, but there are many examples that we cite in the book where lesbians are seen as impossible to victimize, or that rape, that, and this is by police, by prosecutors, by courts, by judges, by juries, by prison officials, and by the media and by the public, that lesbians can't be victimized, that the rape of lesbians is okay to turn them straight, and that lesbians, if they're accused of violence against a man, must have committed it, and that they shouldn't keep their children because they're literally going to eat their young, you know. And that we see that in custody cases. We talk about the Sharon Bottoms case in Virginia in the book, where a woman was denied custody of her kids because, you know, she shouldn't be raising them in a deviant sexual household and a man-hating household. There was no evidence that it was a man-hating household and the fact that they were lesbians. There is an example in the book of seven black lesbians, some of whom were butch and gender nonconforming, who were walking through the village the West Village in New York City and subjected to violence themselves, to sexual harassment, to physical violence, to threats of sexual violence. Yet when they defended themselves, they were immediately framed as a gang, as a perpetrators of violence against this heterosexual man. They're even accused of committing a hate crime against a heterosexual man. And sadly, those stories, outrageous as they are, and they were characterized in the local newspapers as the lesbian wolf pack, as a seething sapphic septet. I mean, really, there's like this reinforcement of this notion of man-hating lesbians in just deeply racialized ways over and over and over, to the point where when they were in front of a judge, they got sentences of up to 11 years of incarceration for defending themselves against a sexual assault. That, again, is just how these stories play out in ways that really make it impossible for people to see people for their real circumstances, their complexity of their circumstances, and really flattens things out into these caricatures and stories that get used against people like Eileen Wuornos, we call those women, that group of women, the New Jersey Seven, because they were in town from New Jersey. And the story that often sticks out from the book in my mind, among many of them, is the story of Bernine Amata, who my co-author Joey Mogul had the privilege of representing in Illinois, who was accused of killing a man she met at a bar one night. And the motive that was assigned to her for the killing was that he made an unwanted sexual advance against her, and she, being a hardcore lesbian, and the prosecutors literally used this term in court, was so enraged by this conduct as to kill the man, whereas a normal heterosexual woman would not have been so enraged by this conduct as to kill. And that language was deployed in a courtroom and was used by the prosecutor to argue that she should get the death penalty, and it was successful in getting her the death penalty. And this was not in 1952, it was not in 1918, it wasn't in 1895, it was in 1991. And she was on death row up until the time that Governor Ryan commuted all of the death sentences in Illinois, and remains in prison for the rest of her natural life, notwithstanding the fact that she was also a survivor of child rape. She was also a survivor of sexual abuse. She was also a survivor of violence. And in fact, there was lots of conflicting and circumstantial evidence as to who might have been involved in the death of the person who was killed. There was another person present. It was the other person's knife that killed the victim. I mean, really, there was a lot of information out there, but because the prosecutor was able to really mobilize this historic and still present day story about lesbians as man-hating killers, he was able to secure the death penalty against her in ways that, and using language that if they were used anywhere but in a criminal courtroom, they would produce outrage. There would be millions of people marching on Washington if any other government official stood up and accused someone of wrongdoing purely on the grounds that they were a hardcore lesbian. But because it was mobilized against someone who was already criminalized, who was already Latina, and therefore they could merge that with stories of hot-tempered Latinas and knife-wielding Latinas. I mean, these kind of archetypes can meld and be even stronger when you bring racialized stories in with gendered stories, in with stories around queer folks. And it was just such a powerful story that they were able to mobilize it to get the death penalty for her. And that, to me, like Eileen Wuornos' story, is a story where someone could not see the reality of Bernine Amata's life and her experience of violence. They could only see her as a mad lesbian perpetrator of violence.
How do you feel about pursuing a path that works to break down these archetypes? They are, as you just said, very powerful. Is there hope?
There is hope. And I think the hope that we talk about in the last chapter of the book, which is campily named Over the Rainbow, I appreciate Gary's last night sort of saying we need more camp in our movements. We need to go back to the time when we were engaged in queer liberation movements in many ways. And what we talk about in that chapter are what we think is the hope and promise of challenging the criminalization of sexual and gender nonconformity and of queer folks. And that is to focus on placing us solidly within our communities and our lives and organizing in multi-issue, multi-racial, multi-generational ways so that we're not just focused on a gay agenda or a mainstream white equality agenda, that we're focused on racial justice, that we're focused on immigrant justice, that we're focused on economic justice, we're focused on anti-capitalist or anti-racist work or anti-oppression work, and that we see where queer experiences and lives fit in with these larger struggles, and that we frame ourselves as part of our communities and that we engage in our struggles as part of our communities. I think also that we as LGBT people could do a lot more to build community with folks who are being criminalized and punished around sexual and gender nonconformity. And we talk a lot about organizing in the States that happened in the 70s, where there was a lot of solidarity across prison walls between queers on the outside and queers on the inside. And it was premised on this notion that the people on the outside were just unincarcerated queers, like, or they were pre-incarcerated queers, or they just were like not behind bars today queers, but that the possibility was very real that anyone could be behind bars tomorrow. And so that there was this real notion of community and solidarity. Whereas now, because we're trying to distance ourselves from the bad queers in order to prove that we're the good LGBT people who should be accepted onto society and then, you know, given a show like Ellen, that we distance ourselves and isolate ourselves from members of our own communities. And so to reach across to humanize people who are queer and behind bars, and to humanize their experiences of sexual violence behind bars, that's what's so ironic about this sort of, you know, tell me what I need to know or I'll, you know, you'll be behind bars being raped by the prisoner's story that the cops tell so often and that the police shows tell so often, is that the people who experience the highest rates of sexual violence in prison are LGBT people, including lesbians, including gay men, including transgender women. And so to really humanize and forefront those stories and show that, in fact, you know, we're not sexually degraded predators. We're often preyed on, that we are not people out there trying to, you know, lesbians aren't out there killing men. Lesbians are out there being raped by men who are trying to, you know, convert them or who are trying to punish them for gender nonconformity. And to really sort of not to place us, I think it's also dangerous to say, look, we're victims too, because then that sort of reinforces this notion of good, innocent victims and then the bad perpetrators. And it's very hard when you don't conform to society's notions of what a victim is to stay in that box. And it's very easy to slide back into the bad people box. So we don't want to contribute to setting up that dichotomy, but we just want to make sure that we see people in their full multidimensional humanity. And then I think also we need to challenge ourselves to look at our complicity in policing, whether that's around policing of violence against LGBT people or policing of our neighborhoods generally. And I think we need to think about ways to build and strengthen our communities and build and strengthen with other communities so that our response to violence isn't to bring in more violence from the state, but to take responsibility for each other's safety and for each other's humanity and each other's security, and that and to, you know, enact what Gary was talking about last night as people's security as opposed to national security, and really figure out what that looks like. I think those are the ways in which we break down the criminalizing archetypes and build with our community, all members of our community, the most marginalized members of LGBT communities, and also the communities that hold us, communities of color, communities of immigrants, communities of criminalized people, and really build out in that way in order to break down the systems and stories that society sets up to divide us.
Is there anything else that you feel has been left unsaid about the topic?
I think there's a lot that's been left unsaid, but that's what the great thing about Queer Injustice and Gary's book is, that they're conversation starters. I mean, in some ways, you know, we never thought that we were going to produce the comprehensive, ultimate, and definitive tome on criminalization of LGBT people in the United States. We thought that we were going to bring together and amplify stories that were out there, organizing that was out there, documentation and movement building that was going on, and hopefully use the privilege that we had to take some time and put it all into one place to really lift up and amplify and point to work of organizations and people who are having conversations that are continuing beyond, and that this book is sparking conversations. Apparently the book was used as a prop on the Colbert show to show like how to talk about teaching gay history in California, and how like right-wing people were so opposed to that, and that, you know, they sort of held up the book as, look, they might actually teach this, you know. And I think that it shows that it's starting conversations on the right, it's starting conversations on the left, and that was our goal. And so if we've succeeded in doing that, then we're really happy, and I'm really excited to engage with the folks who are here this weekend for the CopWatch conference. I went to the first International CopWatch conference, and I'm really excited to be here to look at how the conversation has evolved over the past few years and how our strategies have evolved and how we're going to really move forward to build towards liberation for everyone in our communities.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.